Hello and welcome to the In the Money Players podcast. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital. I've lost track of the shows. I'm supposed to say what show number it is. I'm going to guess show 105. Don't ask me what day it is. No, I actually know that. It is Friday, January 10th. We're going to be talking about races from Saturday, January 11th on this show. We'll be joined a bit later by our old pal Chris Felica to talk a little bit about his horse playing and look forward to a certain football game that's happening Monday night. Chris, I think 3 years in a row has come on the show and told us what to bet and been right every single time, and with some prices too in that spot. So we'll be curious to hear what he has to say. Before that, we're going to look back very quickly at an interesting contender for the Triple Crown races we saw last weekend, and we'll look ahead to some graded stakes at Gulfstream and Santa Anita that are coming up this Saturday. And to help us do it, we've got the usual co-host of this show. He is back once again on the planet Texas. He's a former NHC champion, tour champion, that is. We call him the people's champion around here. He's Jonathan Kinchin. What's up, JK?
PTF, what's the word? I'm picking out my hair. It's what I got to do when I get a haircut. You know, I just kind of keep it kind of messy, curly, nappy when I'm out and about. But then when you get it cut, you got to like kind of pick it out so they can kind of get everything even. And it's a very interesting photo that I sent you of my hair and what I'm dealing with here. But it's always fun to send pictures to people looking like Questlove or Jim Brown or something like that.
I think I might have to put that picture on the blog. Do you mind?
Let me double check. Let me see.
I'm going to leave the pause in. Oh, I'm going to leave the pause in. Can I put it in or no? It's up to you.
Look at this. The look on my face is ridiculous. I'll get you one.
Okay, get me one that I can use. It doesn't have to be. Yeah, you look a little bit too happy about the fact that your hair is practically a foot long. You didn't mind when I put your memoji up, so I figured this was going to be a slam dunk, but this time I did decide to ask permission.
Oh, you set me up good. So good for this one. Did you say memoji?
Memoji.
Like mimosa, but a memoji?
Isn't it a memoji?
You get mad at me. You get mad at me when I call you a boo.
Well, what the hell? What do you call that thing? I'm pretty sure that's what it's called.
I'm fairly certain it's a meme-moji.
Oh,
like a meme.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're probably right. I take it back. I'd only seen it written on my iPhone. Oh, my God. Speaking of iPhones, how great is it that now the whole In the Money team has one? No more ugly green texts from Drew Cotney. How fantastic is that?
Look, if you don't have an iPhone, I'm telling you right now, someone in your life, a group of your friends, has taken you out of a group text. Not because you're not funny, not because they don't like you, but because your phone is screwing it up for everybody else. So listen, I'm telling you, one of my best friends in the world, he's hilarious. He has been eliminated from one of our group texts because if you send a video, it like comes all weird and small and distorted. Just stop it. Get an iPhone, grow up, it's not a big deal.
What are the chances you think we can get Apple as a sponsor for these shows? We're putting together our new sell sheets for the 2020 season with passion like that coming from you, JK. I mean, you'd think we might be a little bit too small of a fish for those guys, but given your affinity for the brand, who knows?
Did you see Ricky Gervais' Golden Globe speech?
I didn't. I saw a clip of highlights, and it was amazing. I think he's absolutely hilarious. Which one are you referring to?
He took a little jab at Apple, saying you know that something about their streaming service and how all these companies act woke, and it's ironic because they have their products are made in sweatshops in China, and then they showed Tim Cook was in the audience, and they quick cut to him during it. It was very, very funny.
Oh, that's too funny. That very, very typical Gervais style humor. But anyway, if we do have to have a meeting out in Cupertino, JK, I nominate you to go. And I think you should go with the hair blown out. Who knows? Maybe this recent kerfuffle and questions about their wokeness mean they'd be more likely to do business with you.
Tim, I tell you what, I'm not sure about the podcast, but they've got a guy with an afro. I think it'd be great for the brand.
my goodness. Fantastic stuff. All right. We don't have a lot of time today. We've got a guest to get to, and we're not going to be able to do a full hour. I think we can get it up to about 45 minutes today. That's decent. That'll get you through the weekend. With all the content we're putting out, you know, maybe you'll have to go listen to a Red Board Rewind or something if you can't get enough of us. There's actually been some great stuff Spencer's been up to lately. I do recommend checking that out, as well as this week's In the Ring. But in the time that we have here today, I want to start off by looking back to last weekend and Authentic's win out at Santa Anita. JK, you're in tight with B-Squared, as you call him. What do you think about this horse, Authentic? How serious of a contender is he for this year's Kentucky Derby?
No, he was extremely impressive. He's an intermission of Cole, was obviously in the barn of Bob Baffert, and he could be one of those that jumps up and kind of slaps everybody in the face as kind of his newcomer. Won't have to overcome the Apollo curse of getting the win and at Del Mar in November, but I don't think that curse applies to Bob Baffert anyway. So
I was going to say, I thought we'd long put that to bed. I was sort of hoping we'd never hear the words Apollo curse again. I don't even know what you're talking about.
No, you got to keep saying it just to upset the people on Twitter. I'm gonna do it all. I'm going to tweet it every time a horse wins from now on. Apollo curse, watch out. Oh, my gosh. I can imagine how many people would be talking noise about that. So, you know, look, it's one of those situations where we talk often about these Derby preps and these maiden winners, and we talk about how – you know, I'm not, you know, it was great. That was a cool performance. I'm not like running the cut in line. This is the type of horse, based on how he ran, the greenness he showed, the how he opened up and how he did it easy and he did it going two turns. This is the type of horse that could actually progress moving forward. And if you find this one in the right field, he's one that you could lean on late. He got a pretty good figure for that race. So we'll see how he continues to progress. It is Bob Baffert. It is a 3-year-old. We'll see what happens with Authentic next. But I was impressed.
I get what you're saying about how the greenness gives him room for upside that a more professional performance also getting the same 90 buyer speed figure would not. But the thing that makes me worry, and I don't think this bothers me thinking about him full time, like the long-term potential, but thinking about him the next time, I'm just so used to the Baffert runners being so professional, having been through his program, and I wonder if it suggests something that's not super mentally strong potentially about Authentic. Now, I'm not looking to bet against him in his next start, but before, I also wouldn't necessarily be looking to bet him future book wise for the Kentucky Derby right now, especially as the favorite at 16-1, knowing that there might be a little bit of a mental issue. I would assume next time he comes out, he wears blinkers. If he steps up again, and he well might, that's when I'd be more willing to latch on to him. I feel like the price just isn't enough for one I have genuine questions about. Sometimes that's when you get the value, is when it's sort of an unknown thing. But I feel like you're sort of getting the worst of both worlds here, where the hype is on, the value isn't there, there's still a question to be answered. I'm firmly in the hold mode when it comes to this runner going forward.
I saw a couple of old workout reports that suggested Authentic needs blinkers. So we'll see if they get popped on for his next start. That'd be something if you trip notes, maybe put in your trip note, maybe put blinkers ? That way, if the horse shows up with blinkers, it's something to be aware of. And then, you know, maybe if he doesn't show up with blinkers, it's another thing to be aware of. Maybe it was something with a bit or something with the rider's mistake, or, you know, so I think it's just an important note that can help you, down the line, something you might forget when they show up in the, whatever that's, what's a San Felipe is next. Or maybe I guess the Robert Lewis, then the San Felipe, but I don't know if Robert Lewis is too quick. So whichever one he shows up in next.
Yeah, he'll certainly be seen again on the trail and is one to pay attention to. And I'll say this, there's a lot of trainers for whom adding blinkers in graded stakes I would see as a negative. I would not see it as a negative for this horse. It just seems like the logical thing to do. And Baffert's had success with that particular move. I will probably be trying to beat next time, just in case I'm right. But I'm also not going to be a hero, as we talk about so often. Depending on what the sequence is, you know, it could end up just being a pass race or a race where I still find a way to try to use Authentic next time, depending on what my opinion is, either vertically or horizontally in the sequence where he shows up. Okay, enough on that. Let's talk about, actually, I wasn't planning on this, but we're going to do it because you joked about the Apollo curse recently, Ron Flatter, I should have the tweet in front of me, but he just pointed out about how as time has gone on, the starting dates of Kentucky Derby winners have gotten later and later. Very interesting point. Somebody I was chatting with on Twitter suggested that this was a direct result of the point system, and now that there's this path that's tilted towards longer races in the three-year-old year that get you into the Kentucky Derby, that trainers are changing how they train to get horses the points, almost like advantage play. You even use the term EV. This is the EV strategy now to get your horse to the Derby, is to start later, get these points where you have to get them, and get yourself in the field on the first Saturday in May. I think that makes sense. I also think it's just sort of natural with how few starts horses have now. And, you know, there's not really a huge advantage to starting these two-year-olds early if the plan is to target the Triple Crown races. I was just curious to get your thoughts, JK, on why this is. And maybe we'll bring this up again. I'd love to hear an industry perspective. I'd love to hear what Sean Tugel has to say about something like this. But we'll start off by posing that question to you.
So when you started that conversation, and before you said that you'd had a conversation on Twitter and someone said point system, if you had just thrown it directly to me, my answer was going to be, I don't know, I guess I'd blame it on the point system, but I got to be honest, that feels like kind of a lazy excuse. And I feel like people are using that excuse also for why favorites keep winning the Derby. And here's my thing. I can accept that is why favorites are winning the Derby, but as to like why the two-year-olds are, you know, that have, you know, two-year-olds didn't run a two, now they're running a three. I just think it's kind of, you know, look, there wasn't a whole lot of like, you know, six, seven furlong Derby preps, as you will. I mean, in the Swale, the San Vicente out at California is at 7/8. You know, I guess maybe the race that they have up at it's not Saratoga, but at Aqueduct, I'm going to go blank on it. It is the Bayshore. So I don't think that that's really the reason why. I think it's probably different training styles is what has led to not needing that 2-year-old start. A lot of the horses aren't battle tested. So if you're a lightly raced horse, you show up, you're not facing some grizzled 12 race veteran who's got, you know, stones in his belly. You know what I mean? It's just a different game than I think it was in the past. You know, we always joke, Pete, when I'll say, man, I worry about the horse coming back in 3 weeks, and you giggle when I, you know, when we say that. And it's like, that used to be a long time. And now it's like 6 weeks is like it seems like the norm. So I think it's more just a change in the culture as in the training culture. And I think that's had a lot more to do with it. I would also say the same thing with human athletics is just science. It's kind of helped performance along, I think. I mean, you know, what LeBron James is able to do with his body and the gifts that he was given athletically are endless compared to what Michael Jordan was able to do with his. The science with physical fitness and health and nutrition and supplements and things like that is, you know, LeBron's got a much broader area to pick from than someone like maybe Jordan did 30 years ago.
It's a great point. And I'll piggyback two ideas very quickly because we do have to get into these races. One, I'm a believer that horses are faster than ever and that the reason the figures aren't higher is that racing surfaces have changed. I'm not all about this, oh, the breed just is in trouble and isn't as good, and that's why times haven't gotten faster. Because, of course, times have gotten faster in every other athletic endeavor. When you look at the Olympics and things in horse racing, we have a bit of a stasis. I think horses are faster now. I think racing surfaces are different. That's just my opinion. And if I'm right, with horses being faster, it's logical that they'd need more time between races to recover. It's logical it would lead to exactly what you're describing. And then I just wanted to quickly say on the favorites doing better since the point system, I fully believe that, and I think it's a function of pace. When you don't have the stretch-out sprinters in there, it makes the top riders' jobs that much easier on the best horses, not getting in situations where moves get mistimed. You and I have both spoken not on air, but I know we've both spoken off air to Gary Stevens about the ride on point given in the Derby. That was far from the only time when that happened, when it's easy for the best horse to mistime a ride when you've got a really good sprinty type out in front of you setting a pace that's unsustainable. You take those types out of the race, it makes the job easier for the best horses. I do believe that there is a correlation there. Okay. I wish I could give you time to piggyback on that, but we do not have time for the tangent, JK. So we're going to dive right into these races. We'll put a pin in that. Maybe we'll tackle it with Sean Tugel on an upcoming In the Ring Pedigree podcast. I've already plugged it once this show, but I'll plug it again. I just was really happy with the incredible array of guests we put together for this week's In the Ring show with Safi Joseph and Mike Campbell and Kevin Blake. And I recommend that people take a look over there at that. Let's move to Gulfstream, race number 8. It's the Grade 3 Marshua's River. I was going to take a shot here with number 2, Piece by Piece, to potentially wire these for Rudy Brissett. Looks to have a pace edge. The maiden win was earned, cutting out Red Fractions on time form. That race has produced a next out winner. Now, somebody might say, hey, look at how low the purse is in that Tampa maiden race. Isn't it going to be really hard for this one to step up and run into graded stakes? And the answer is yes, it's going to be hard, but maybe it's not quite as hard as you think, because even though the Tampa purse structure is cheap, we know a lot of horsemen love running their turf horses there. They just love that turf course, especially compared to Gulfstream's turf course. And here we've got a Hall of Fame rider in the irons. If I could lock in the 20-1, this would be an absolute play. Not sure we're going to get all of that. JK, what do you think about my pick, and what do you think about the Marshua's River?
I think that horse will be single digits to start. The 20-1 thing I don't get. I guess it's just like I see Chad, I see two other stakes horses, 20-1. I don't
think the horse. You think it's a bad line? In other words, I still like the horse.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Rudy's. Rudy's always liked this horse. I remember at Keeneland he thought the horse was going to need a race. At Churchill he encouraged a mutual friend of ours to have a wager if he wanted. The horse is going to run good at 23-1 and almost won. I think that was like on a mandatory payout pick 6 day. Then comes back to Tampa and wins, wires the field with fast pace figures and a fast final number. A Piece by Piece is a horse that I'm definitely going to use as an A horse. I'm going to also use the two horses that make the most sense, Sweet By and By and Andina Del Sur. I'm going to try to beat Magic Star. And the reason I'm going to try to beat Magic Star is that race at Saratoga was one of the most visually impressive races that Chad Brown runners had had the entire meet. But the figure wasn't that fast, got a nice setup that day, and then came back and didn't run so well. And then comes in off a long break. I think people are going to play the horse because it's Chad. I'm going to try to beat her with the horses that are going to be in front of her early. And I think the three that I named will all be in front of her. And I think you'll get a little bit of value in the multis, not using Chad and using the 4 and the 5 here. But I would not leave out piece by piece. And that'll be my top pick, Piece by Piece.
Oh, nice. We both going there. I like it. Race number 10 is the Grade 3 Tropical Turf. Stop me if you've heard this one, JK. I'm interested in the Mike Maker horses versus the field. Appears to be plenty of pace in here. Exulting last time looked to be compromised by a lack of pace. I think gets a better setup. And Empire of War, I just think looks interesting. Second time Maker back in 14 days. That was yielding last time. Well drawn inside this time. And as for the rest of the field, having learned from experience, I don't particularly want to get beat by Maraud. I would be using Maraud at least as a saver in the tropical turf. What do you like?
Well, I think the conversation always starts with two things about this race. One is anytime I see Gidu in a race, I look at all the speed horses, and you better be thinking American Pharoah, because he is going to absolutely run early and he's going to run fast. And if everything's not perfect for you, you're not beating him, or you're not beating others, because he's gonna break you in half. So that's the first thing I noticed when I saw this race, is that Gidu's in here and he's gonna be on the front end. The second thing I noticed, I think your eyes have to go to, is the probably the most accomplished horse in the field and a threat of Blue. Won the stake of a Saratoga going a mile and 3/16, $1 million race up there. And remember how he won it that day? Got loose on the lead. When Louis Saez was making the habit of winning graded stakes at Saratoga wire to wire, and he did that at a mile and 3/16. Then they stepped him up to a mile and a half. It didn't go that well, ran well enough, cut him back to a mile and 1/8, couldn't get the job done there. Now he's back off a 98-day break with obviously bigger goals for a horse like that moving forward. I don't think Kieran's going to have this horse cranked to be able to withstand what Didu's going to do to him. And a threat of blue is a toss for me in this comeback race going a mile against some other speed horses. I like the horses you mentioned. I'm going to spread it here. Empire War, Marad, so on and so forth. But Exulting was the one that I thought was the most interesting. Has run well at a mile, cutting back a little bit, gets IRAD for Mike Maker. I always pay attention when the Ortiz brothers get on a Maker horse. It doesn't feel like he calls them unless he's got a good one. And so I would think that IRAD will take this one back, have plenty of pace to run into, and will be running late. He's not a horse that can single because of the running style, but he is a horse I can lean on in a race that I think has a very, very good chance of falling apart.
For folks that don't know, we do not talk about these races before the show, except on rare occasions, or sometimes we'll talk about them accidentally if it's something really interesting coming up. I don't know. I've never tracked how we do when we're picking similar horses versus picking different horses. But when we land on horses, it is because we came up with them independently, as is the case in that race. Let's move out to the West Coast, the scene of one of my great mispronunciations, JK. Nothing will ever top whatever it was I called the Alcibiades. I think it was Alcibiades that year. But I do think I had something almost as bad regarding the Las Cienegas at some point out at Santa Anita. That's where we go now. It's race number three. The morning line favorite is Jolie Olympica. This is one I am a little, maybe eager to take on is too strong given the composition of the rest of the field, but is one I feel like you're supposed to take on just based on the idea that you've got a patient trainer with bigger goals down the line, and it just looks like it's going to be too sharp. Perhaps the class is there that Jolie Olympica is just going to run these down, but I'm going to take a shot with another for whom this might be too sharp, but Storm the Hill, to me, attended a hot pace in the Matriarch and should really fit nicely, I think, with the way this race is going to set up. I think the trip is going to be there. I think the talent is there. I'm going to try to get out of here with Storm the Hill in the Las Cienegas. What do you think?
I tell you what, those horses are going to require some something to run into, right? I mean, if you look at Jolie Olympica, you look at the races that she ran in in Brazil. I was going to say overseas. I mean, I guess there's some sea down there. You have to cross over, but
you just have to cross over a canal, really.
Yeah, you could, but you could go all land.
Yes,
if you really wanted to. Can you imagine that van ride up from Brazil to Santa Anita?
Not pretty.
Good night. Yeah. The debut is at 6.5 on good ground. Then they go to 7.5. Then they go to the mile, and it seems like the mile race was the best race. Now you're going to cut this horse back. You're going to start on the dirt, which is where the 5.5 starts at Santa Anita. And then off of a 216-day break, you're going to break on top. And look, if the race falls apart, but I don't see how it falls apart. So tread where you want. It's probably a workout horse. You need to see how the horse is working. But all signs point to no thank you. I agree with Storm the Hill. The only problem is the last five races are at a mile or beyond. The last win was down the hill going 6.5, which we know plays more like the mile. And draws the rail with no speed. Another situation.
I wouldn't say no speed is unfair, though. No speed is unfair. If you look at the pace figures from that strong run last time, I think Storm the Hill can stay very much in touch with presumable front runner Kenton Road here.
So here's my thing. It's not speed. And when they're going the flat mile versus going the 5.5 on the rail, to me, it's not comparable, right? So it does have a really fast, you know, they got fast figures last time in the Matriarch going that mile at 43-1, did have fast numbers early and fast pace figures, but it wasn't really that fast in the context of a 5.5 race. If you go back six races and you look at the Senator Ken Maddie from 2018, look how far back the horse fell going 6.5 down the hill, right? Was 8 beating 6, 6 beating 7. I just don't think the horse has 5.5 speed from the rail. That's my biggest concern.
I think Kenton Road will clearly be loose. I think is that Storm the Hill will be within a couple of lengths at the pace call. And given the non-finish Kenton Road has shown, I think that might be enough for Storm the Hill. But who do you like in here?
I know, that's the problem. I mean, I wanted to take Kenton Road, but I just don't, the horse isn't fast enough the last two starts. If you look back earlier this summer, the horse was faster. So maybe they'll find that form. I mean, I'm going to use Kenton Road and Maltese, but my top pick here is going to be Free Cover, just kind of a crazy horse that could end up getting loose in here. Has some nice figures on the dirt, has some dirt sprint speed, and, you know, ran well enough going 6.5 and 7 in his career, so should finish a little bit, drawn outside. They'll probably be the longest shot on – well, maybe not the longest shot on the board. Maybe in
Eddie Surprise, I think, will be longer.
Eddie Surprise was 4-1 last time coming in off a win for Doug O'Neill. I don't know. I feel like Free Cover, you know, getting on the turf for the first time is one that might – that should be the top pick. Free Cover, I think, is very interesting and what will be a huge price. But, look, the whole goal here is just to beat the one – Storm the Hill and the 3 Jolie Olympica. If you're playing this early sequence, I just don't trust those two horses.
I'd be very careful about fully trying to beat Storm the Hill, but I definitely hear you on Jolie Olympica.
And not to mention, Jolie Olympica is a Drosselmeyer. Like,
stout.
They're going to need to run this race twice for this horse to have a
Nothing against Drosselmeyer. You're just saying distance is, you would think, would be the friend of the progeny.
I would not be on this show right now if it weren't for Drosselmeyer, because he closed out a pick five that gave me the money to lose, to learn how to play a little bit better and help me win the tour. You know what I mean? Like, if That's it wasn't funny. For him, I appreciate him to the full.
All right, we just have a couple of minutes left, JK, and we have one more race to look at. It's the La Cañada. Queen B to you has strong numbers and could get a good trip stalking the speed of Spice Perfection. How do you see it?
Yeah, so this is an interesting race. I actually covered for a new gig that I'm starting. I was going to tell you guys about. CBS Sportsline reached out to have me kind of be one of the racing contributors to their, like, subscription-based deal where they talk about, you know, they talk about basketball and they have bowl picks and all kinds of, like, sports pick stuff through CBS. And Pete and I obviously have always tried to dodge the touty system situation. I don't really want someone, like, paying for my picks. But this is just a pick that'll be included, like, in your $9.99 a month subscription or whatever it is. This is a race that I actually, for my first race, I wrote up with a $100 betting strategy. That's what I decided I'm going to do, Pete. I didn't even talk to you about that.
I'm absolutely shocked you wrote something without me, and it didn't even have me edit it. I don't know where you get the cojones to do that, but I'm impressed.
Oh, trust me. I've moved on. I've upgraded.
You've got a better editor now? So, what, you got Frank Scatoni helping you or something?
No, in fact, it's our buddy Gene Menez.
Gene's good.
I'm working with him on the deal. Gene's at the CBS, and the way it works is Gene and I just kind of talk about the race, and I send him my plays, and then he kind of transcribes it into, like,
very
well, I don't
cool.
have to write.
Believe me, I'm not complaining about not having to do more free work for your, you know, self.
Right. Yeah, so my point is I'm never going to push. I don't want to be like, gross and push people there. But if this is something you're interested in, if you, like, you know, if you play football, you're playing golf and hockey, and you're betting whatever you can get, and you want some insight, this might be the $9 a month might be worth for you to, you know, use those other things. If you listen to this show, you're gonna get the pick anyway, so you don't really need my pick from there. But I am gonna try to beat both backwards here. I thought Derlu is a horse that has that. If you're looking at time form, it actually stands out like a sore thumb. When you see a backward horse with a bunch of brown and a green mixed in there, that's like an automatic toss. If they end up on the grass, it feels to me as if backward's trying to, like, figure something out. And she drew the rail. She's going to be bet because it's him. I'm against her in this spot. And I'm also against Message, because Message had the huge question mark about the two turns. Is the two turns going to work? Is the two turns going to work? You know, a lot of people are going to say the two turn question was answered. Not for me. The horse is loose, on a slow pace, on a sloppy racetrack, and to me, that didn't answer the question. She's going to have to prove it to me again. My top pick was Queen B to use, who I landed on. That's who I'm going to, you know, pick. That's one of my little – in my play, I, you know, had a little win bet on Queen B to you, and then I also built some exactas with Queen B to you and Spice Perfection. He came off that big win in New York with the 2, 4, and 6 underneath. You know, I thought Zusha made a little bit of sense underneath, and Message could still hit the board. And horologist is one of my favorite words to say. But I'm going to try to beat both of these backwards in here, and the top picks are going to be Queen B to you, who I thought was impressive last time.
We've talked about this before. It doesn't mean what you think it means. The study of the measurement of time. All right, our special guest is ready for us, JK. Let's bring him in right now. And now, continuing an annual tradition, we're going to bring in a very special guest and a friend from ESPN College Game Day. It's Chris Felica, the Bear. Chris, how are you?
Getting up to the level of a tradition unlike any other. Hopefully we can reach that kind of run.
Every time you come on here, you give us the winner of an important college football game. We'll get to that by the end of the segment, but we also want to talk to you a little bit about your horse playing. Are we going to see you in a couple of weeks' time out at the NHC?
I hope so. I am embarrassed to admit that I have yet to qualify. I've had a couple of very close calls, and maybe if someone I'm like the first runner-up, I believe, in like one of the contests, and maybe if I luck out and someone can't attend in front of me, I can get the default first. But I actually feel pretty good about this weekend. I won one of the little feeders yesterday into the big qualifier tomorrow, and a couple of spots to try and qualify today as well. So I'm hoping this weekend is kind to me, at least in the tournament. But it's crazy because I've had like a really good year, like in terms of just like normal stuff. But the NHC berth has eluded me, and it's funny how like the first 12 days or so, or 10 days or so of the 2020 calendar year, it started off on January 1st at Gulfstream. I was alive to five horses in the late pick five in the last race. There were a couple of five figures in there, and I did not have the Brian Lynch horse that wound up beating me. And I think I ran second, third, fourth, and fifth. Couple of days ago, I was alive to three horses, including the Antonio Sano horse that looked like he was going to gallop and win for sure. And I got beat by the rail bias Brooks All Mine or whatever it was that. That beat me. And then yesterday, I ran 2-3-4 in that race. And then yesterday, I was alive to four horses in the early pick five. I did not use the Weaver horse, the favorite that wound up winning, and I ran 2-3-4-5 there. So I've been a lot of tight scores in these pick fives at Gulfstream, and I've been yet to harness one in. So hopefully this weekend is going to give me some good luck both on a pick five front and on a qualifying front.
I appreciate that confidence you have, Chris. You did say, though, that despite the recent sob stories, you had a pretty good 2019 overall in terms of your horse play.
Yeah, I did. I mean, obviously, the Derby DQ did me a whole lot of good, and that was probably one of the better days I had for the year. But despite not having a Saratoga was good early and then bad late. Gulfstream was good last year. It's interesting because with everything that went on last year at Santa Anita and out west and and the tracks out there, I didn't play a lot of Santa Anita. And what I did as the result was I started looking at Oaklawn a lot more. And I never really was an Oaklawn player, but in terms of looking for fields and prices and horses that you could play, I'm like, you know what, I'm going to start looking at Oaklawn. And Oaklawn yielded quite a few winners. That cross country pick five turned out to be one of my favorite wagers to play. You incorporate a couple of Aqueduct races, you incorporate a couple of Oaklawn races, and the payoff on some of those pick fives were massive. So with everything, the negative of the California race in Santa Anita, which was a staple of mine, turned into a positive in terms of finding another track to play in Oaklawn.
Bear, you mentioned your Gulfstream, and obviously you spent a lot of time in Miami, and I would assume that's kind of how you found yourself in your current role with College Game Day, with your time in Miami and around the football program. Was Gulfstream Park your time in Miami also, and Calder the equivalent for your involvement in racing, or did it kind of start at an earlier time?
It came earlier than that. Growing up on Long Island, I can remember going to Belmont with my dad to see Tanquishiro Cielo win the Belmont Stakes. My dad's godfather used to write for racing publications, and we had a quarter horse track out by our house, Suffolk Meadows, which was we would go to the track quite a bit. So it started at a young age, then just having access to the Gulfstream Calder in Hialeah at the time as well was great. I remember watching Strike the Gold when the Kentucky Derby. I was at Calder that day, and that was a fun time. I remember the Happy Jazz Band, I think, was in the Florida Derby one year. So Sunday was typically the day to go to the tracks once the football season ended.
Chris, I've been playing around a little. I kind of got back on the Madden bandwagon a little bit. It's taken up some of my time. But I'm building this team, and I ran across two names, and I thought about you when I saw your Miami connection with Frank Gore and Sean Taylor. Were you there when those two guys were there? Because they're two of my favorite football players of all time.
No, I was there a little bit before them. But Sean Taylor is on the Mount Rushmore, favorite Miami Hurricane players of all time. He was just a dynamic player, just an awesome talent, who sadly lost his life way too soon. And it's amazing. Frank Gore still in the league after this. I mean, he talks about a guy who he was injury prone at Miami. He tore his had some knee issues, and he's gone on and had an unbelievable NFL career. So he just knocked off two great Hurricanes. I was there actually 90-94. So when I was there, they did not lose a home game at the Orange Bowl, and won a national championship. Probably should have won another one. And those were some fun times. Russell Maryland, Tino Toretto, Lamar Thomas, Darren Smith, Michael Barrow. Some of those guys were the guys that I was around the team with.
We're going to get you back for a much longer visit soon, Chris, to talk all about your horse playing and your process. We've done some of that in the past, but I think we need to get a really good sit down with you once all this football craziness is over with. But now we're going to try to keep this tradition alive. We'd love to hear your analysis of Monday night's game, and then I'll let Coach Kinchin come back in with a more detailed follow-up about the game. He's far more attuned to what's going on than I am, but I have had some good success just blindly following you on the betting front, and I plan on doing that once again.
My hunch is that I will say up front, this is least, but the last few years, like, I've been dating back to like the 2010 Auburn Oregon title game. Like, I didn't have a ton of confidence or a really strong conviction that day. I landed on Oregon and wound up being a loser. I don't have a super, super strong conviction like I did last year with Clemson against Alabama. Basically every year going back to that 2010 game. Unfortunately, I've been on the right side of everyone since then. If I had to play this game pre-kick and you want to take a side of LSU or Clemson prior to kick, I would lean towards taking Clemson plus the points. And it's solely a numbers type play. If you would have asked a lot of people before the playoffs started that, they would have said, yeah, Clemson would be a small favorite over LSU. So now you're looking at off of a little bit of an overreaction against an Oklahoma team that really should not have been in the playoffs. And a team that they were four by default because they won the Big 12 and they were the only other team with one loss in the committee. Oh, yeah, they're the fourth best team in the country. And they really weren't. And they were depleted with injuries and suspensions. And LSU just crushed them up and down the field. Now, I get there could have been an adjustment to making LSU favorite maybe by 2 or 3 or 3.5. But we're talking about like an 8-point adjustment from what people thought before the playoff began to now. And just based on that, I think you just have to kind of play Clemson plus the points. And my instinct here says that either Clemson wins the game or LSU wins by double digits. Indeed, their offense has been unstoppable. And they continue on with that run. But I mean, if you look at Clemson and what Dabo Swinney's done, not only is another, but you go back in this run since 2002, which started with a win over LSU in the bowl game. Like, in their 11 bowl games, they've only been favored twice, and they're 10-1 against the number, and 9-2 straight up in that span. It's unbelievable that Dabo continually gets to play this underdog, lack of respect role. All they do is continue to win. So I think that's going to come into play. Now, look, maybe this LSU offense is as good as advertised. Maybe Clemson, we saw some cracks against Ohio State, and they gave up 516 yards, I think it was, and a lot of big plays, and maybe Joe Burrow is just is too good for them and outthinks them. But my lean, if you have to play something pregame, would be towards taking maybe play it both ways, maybe play Clemson on the money line and LSU minus 10 if you can find some adjusted numbers. But if you just had to make the one play, I'd lean towards taking Clemson plus 1.
I like what Clemson has accomplished. I agree. You know, not too long ago, Dabo Sweeney was a wide receivers coach, and now he's arguably one of the greatest coaches in college football that we have. So that's obviously a cool thing to see, knowing how difficult it is to move up the coaching ranks and to do it with success. But I think this kind of goes down to one simple thing. I think that OSU probably should have won the game against Clemson. Ohio State played well in the first half, and they just fell apart. And Clemson kind of got their way back in the game and finished the game when it mattered. The biggest thing that I can take from this from a schematic standpoint is that Clemson ran the ball with their quarterback. The QB run game was significantly more against Ohio State than they had shown all year. I think they were averaging like 6 quarterback runs a game. And they ran, you know, Trevor ran it 16 times against Ohio State. I think he probably caught Ohio State off guard a little bit with some of the schematic stuff. You saw a lot of ends chasing back, him pulling on the zone read. LSU saw that film. They've had about 3 weeks to prepare, and that will be a completely different situation. Those ends won't be crashing down nearly as aggressively. Obviously, they have to set up Travis at the end to run a little bit better, but I think LSU is in another league offensively. And from a defensive standpoint, let's not forget, not too long ago, LSU was a defensive school. So they got some cat daddies on defense. I like LSU a lot in this game. I'm not crazy about the line. I'd love to be alive to LSU in a money line situation. Maybe if you have another NFL opinion, play a teaser and then try to tease LSU down to just winning. But I like LSU in the game outright. I don't really have a play when it comes to the line.
You mentioned the idea of potentially having an in-game opinion here. How would you look when you're making in-game bets? How do you look to structure them? Do you come up with a hypothesis beforehand? If I see X, then I'll bet Y. Or how do you approach the in-game wagering as a general rule?
Yeah, I think there's a list or a thought process of trying to think of certain things that you want to look for. But I think the way I approach it, it's just kind of observing and anticipating. And maybe if there's a lot of success for a team early and they don't necessarily get points or it's been tilted on one side of the field and the game is still in doubt and one team really hasn't had a ton of success, it's basically trying to say, okay, if this continues to happen, the points are going to come. And right now we're seeing a very low number on it and some value on that particular side. So I think it's trying to anticipate what I think will happen in the game based on what I've noticed so far. But JK was talking about the Trevor Lawrence running and stuff. Like I think that was kind of out of necessity last week. With Ohio State's corners and secondary guys are really strong physical players, and they took Ross and Higgins out of the game. And Higgins actually got hurt, and then when he came back into the game. LSU's secondary is not that style of secondary. Stingley is more of a react and run type of corner. Stevens, I think, is a liability in coverage. Delpit, when he has to cover, I think is a little bit of a liability in coverage. So I think Ross and Higgins might have a better game Monday night than some people think. I actually think Higgins at plus 25. Is what I saw on DraftKings. It's a good play to maybe score the first touchdown of the game. Maybe if you're looking on the LSU side, maybe Joe Burrow at plus 1,200 to score the first touchdown of the game. You talked about Trevor Lawrence running. You flash back to the Georgia SEC championship game and Joe Burrow's ability to elude the rush and make plays once they break down. He could find himself in a position maybe to score the game's first touchdown at a nice number as well.
A lot of great info there, Chris. We're going to let you go. We know you've got a lot to do, but before you get out of here, remind the listeners where they can find much more from you.
Well, Stan and Steve and I posted the pod the other day, so that is up wherever you get your podcast. our column on ESPN.com. We just posted this morning, so that's there. College game day, Monday, all day long, Monday afternoon. I think we start at 3 o'clock Eastern. We'll be on right up until the game. And then afterwards, Daily Wager, Friday afternoon, Saturday, Sunday, Monday as well. So there is no shortage of places to find myself, Jeff, and Steve, and whoever else you tend to follow and back with your football wager.
Great stuff, Chris. Godspeed this weekend. We hope to see you out at the NHC. Even if you don't make it, I encourage you to try to get out there for a day just to come and hang out. As you know, it's a fun horse player party out there.
Yeah, I think there might be a little spot. For some reason, I'm sitting there for a week of February after the Super Bowl, and I'm not holding a seat. There might be one of those last-minute conversations had with the better half about, this is last chance qualifier that I can get out there and play and have one last chance. So I think the chances are good. I'll be out there one way or another.
I like to hear it. We will be talking soon. Thanks so much for your time, Chris.
Take care, guys.
That's going to do it for this edition of the show. I'll thank Jonathan Kinchin and Chris Felica one more time. We'll also thank our sponsors, including 10 Strike Racing, Black Type Thoroughbreds, the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation, and Stats Race Lens among them. Most of all, I want to thank all of you for listening and making these shows so much fun to do. This show's been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's business manager is Drew Cotney. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. I'm Peter Thomas Fornital. May you win all your photos.